Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
Betrayal may shatter our faith in others, but it should never shatter our faith in ourselves. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I'm an adult child of an alcoholic and dysfunctional family who realized this at 9 years sober after dating two alcoholics named Brian back to back. If you have not heard that story, you need to do so. Go listen to my very first episode. This is the podcast where we talk about what the hell to do when you realize that your childhood screwed you up more than you initially thought. We curse here. You've been warned. I'm an acquired taste. You've been warned. Welcome aboard this hot mess of a ship. So today, folks, we are diving deep with therapist and host of the podcast, The Addicted Mind, Mr. Dwayne Osterlund. I've been wanting to have him on the podcast for quite some time, and we're diving into some topics that we haven't really tackled much before, but some things that I've been wanting to dive into, in particular, porn addiction, because y'all, this is like a huge societal issue and there's no shame there, but that's just the reality of it. And it's really interesting because, you know, Dwayne has been helping people navigate sexual addictions for years. And so it's just interesting hearing his perspective and his experience of just seeing how technology has changed the landscape when it comes to sexual addictions. And I mean, it's just interesting to think about it. In general, right? Like here in 2026, just the way that technology is shaping and the way it's showing up in our trauma, in our trauma responses, in process addictions, just the added baggage, the added layer of damage and changes that is being done to the brain as a result of all this tech shit, you know? At the same time, it's like, it's wonderful, right? Because we have access to all of these healing resources and because of technology, you're listening to my voice right now. But then it also adds in all this other junk, right? I don't know what other word to describe it other than junk. So yeah, we're diving into that porn addiction, other sexual addictions, technology addictions. And another really interesting piece is so Dwayne helps in his private practice too. He helps couples navigate healing from sexual betrayal. And let me just tell you, like this process is no small feat. So he's breaking down the unique challenges there of rebuilding trust, you know, the long journey of repair and what it takes to heal both people in that relationship. So this is just a fascinating conversation all around. So let's just get on with the damn show, shall we? But first, let's talk about what you need to damn the Join Shit Show, my online support community where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. Thank God for technology in this respect, right? Because you can have access to a support community at your fingertips, in your back pocket, available to you 24/7 through our chat. We have 6 weekly Zoom support groups. I probably already said that. It's been a long day, folks. It's been a long day. So damn the join. This is relational trauma, folks. We heal relational trauma through safe relationships. And this is the place where you can do so for less than a damn dollar a day. So you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever. How about we just do the damn thing already? Okay, let's just do it. Let's take those little fingers, scroll to the show notes, or take those little fingers and type up adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow. Yes, you can do it. I have faith. Next, give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, whatever we do, please, give me a 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. All right, y'all. We have like a podcast OG, Mr. Dwayne Osterlin, host of The Addicted Mind. I also saw you have are you still doing your couples podcast?
No, I'm no longer doing that podcast.
No more. How long have you been doing The Addicted Mind?
Oh my gosh. I've been doing The Addicted Mind probably now almost 7 years, I think.
You've done a lot of episodes.
Yeah.
Still going strong.
You know, it's funny. When I set out to do The Addicted Mind podcast, I said to myself, okay, well, I'll do 104 episodes. And I picked 104 because I like 2 years, 52 episodes, 52 weeks in a year, 104. That's what I'll do. And it just really kind of grew on its own. And I just love doing it because I get to meet people like you. I get to meet all these experts out there and have these amazing conversations with people that I probably would have never met in any other way. Mm-hmm. And so there's that. I love doing that. And then the other part of it, which really just surprised me, is so many people reaching out for this information, just wanting to know what's going on. Like, how do I fix my life? How do I get through what I'm struggling with? And just letting them know they're not alone out there. It feels so alone, right? Like when you're in your pain, your misery, your shame, you feel like you're the only one out there, right, with that. And I think when you hear all these other people and their voices, right, that they've gotten through it, even if they're doing their own work and now they're a coach or they're promoting their new book or their product, whatever it is, but you see them, they've gotten through whatever that was to the other side. And it's like, if you're listening, you're stuck, you can do this too. People do it. People get better.
Yeah. Right? And then they find the next thing that they have to overcome.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Welcome to life, right?
Yeah. The never ending onion.
But hopefully.
The never ending onion.
Yeah. But hopefully we can weather those storms a little bit better, a little Absolutely. Bit easier. Doesn't mean life isn't challenging, but
no,
it's still there. Right?
I was going to do 8 to 10 episodes. You were at 104. Oh, really? I was like, I'll do 8, maybe 10. And I just never stopped. So.
And you just never stop. Once you get going, I mean, it's so rewarding to do.
It is. So here's where I like to begin. So when did you come to the realization that you were impacted more by your childhood than you initially thought?
Oh, that's a good question. Because for me, you know, I went into rehab when I was really young. I went into rehab when I was like 17 years old because I was drinking all the time and I was just a mess. You know, depressed, suicidal, drinking all the time through the week. And so, you know, with that, I jumped into recovery. And with that, you start to explore all your own history. And so I think for me, I understood that my early experiences impacted me. Mm-hmm. I think as I've gone through life, like you said earlier, the onion, right? Like you peel away the layers and you see like, oh, I thought I dealt with that. Oh, surprise. Here it is again. Right. And you're like, oh shit, I haven't dealt with that. But through my life, I've been able to look at it on deeper levels as I move through. And And as I've changed, right, as we change through our life, I think I also see the impact in different ways mm-hmm. with different insights. And some of those are hard-won insights. You know, some of them came easy, but it was always a continued process, I think.
So is your sobriety date when you were 17?
So for me, I wouldn't really say that because I got clean for a long time. And then I drank again, mm-hmm. right? I started drinking. And
at what age?
Well, I was 17. And then I probably in my 20s at some point. And really for me, it was more, I was coping with the alcohol, but my issue was more around depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. So once I started to resolve that, for me, alcohol didn't play as a big a role in my mm-hmm. life. And so I had experimented and tried and found that it didn't really impact me in the same way. And I don't drink now just because I don't want to drink and it's not good for my health and not good for my mind. But so I was a little bit different in that. So that's probably why I'm a little more in that harm reduction piece. And I think everybody's different. So I kind of walked through that. I also kind of, for me, understand that I have an addictive personality. So I have to be aware of that. But that's kind of my journey as I move through that, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the way that I view alcoholism and addiction has, you know, shifted and changed so much over the years. And I feel like when I, in my early years of sobriety, just having such a narrow-minded view of like what it is mm-hmm. and this is the way that you get sober and this is kind of the only thing that works. And
right.
that's, you know, shifted and changed over the year. And I realize it's not a one-size-fits-all. I'm curious, was that unfolding like for you? When you first got clean at 17, were you under the impression that my problem is alcoholism or addiction? And how did that how did you come to terms with like the depression and the anxiety being more of a thing? Like, what was that like for you?
So the way I would do it, that was the way all of it was really manifesting for me mm-hmm. was that was the real visible part, right? Because I was drinking all the time and I was drinking during the week and I'm a 17-year-old kid in high school, you know, drinking in the middle of the week. I mean, it was that way. And then, you know, through that process and jumping into recovery, I think I also had time. And I think what was really valuable for me, especially my young brain, was to stay away from alcohol for that time mm-hmm. that my, you know, at 17, my brain was still developing. So it really helped me as I got older. And I said, I really wondered about this. And then I tried that. I mean,
what made you like, wonder about that?
I think that's a good question. I think, you know, I was just looking at the whole paradigm because I wasn't finding myself like wanting to go back to that or, you know, it just wasn't a part of my life. And so, you know, in a way I said, I'm going to see what that's like. I'm going to see how that works in my life and tried that. And I had a couple of times where I did get drunk and did a couple of things, but it really just wasn't, it didn't have that pull anymore. And it didn't have that draw for me. And I think because I had been working a lot on my own self, my own depression and anxiety, it was like an experiment, I guess, and seeing like, how does this fit for me? What is this like? And kind of discovering that for me, it wasn't the issue for me. Right. Now with the depression and anxiety, that was something that was an issue that I had to work on. And working through those pieces, I think, like I was saying earlier, I've taken different transitions, right? I think like when you struggle with anxiety or something, it tends to come in waves in your life when certain things are happening in your life. So, you know, dealing with that as those things have come along, and then understanding all the other aspects of life and growing and yourself and everything like that.
When you went into treatment at 17, what was the response of like your family? Was this like very much like the spotlight was on you? Was it seen as like this is indicative of sounding the alarm bells on like a larger, broader like systems issue?
at the time, I don't think I had as much insight into that. But I also feel I was kind of blessed because I did have a supportive family in a way that wanted me to get support. But I will say at the same time, all the family dynamics were still at play. And that's where, as you go through life and you go into deeper work, understanding your own role in the family and all that, that's probably later work for me, not at the time. But, you know, they could see that, yeah, okay, you're struggling, you need some kind of support. So they were supportive of that. And I feel very blessed to have had that support. And even though they didn't understand it, they didn't get it, they didn't see it, but that was part of how I was able to get into a rehab and get that support too. So I was lucky in that way.
What role did you play?
Oh, me? I was the hero of the family.
Were you the oldest?
No, it's middle.
Okay.
Right. So I was the hero, the caretaker, the placator. I put those in there. I was keeping everything together, right? In that role. That was me.
And what happened when you no longer played that role?
That's interesting because it took me time to understand that. So I really didn't understand that till later in my life to really be able to see it on another level. I think, you know, I'd look at like, I don't know if you're familiar with like Virginia Satir's work.
Mm-mm.
I think you would like systems work. She was a systems therapist from the 70s and 80s. And there's this idea that, you know, a family kind of operates at a status quo level, right? Like they have a status quo. Everybody knows their role. Everybody does what they do. And when they start to break that role, they go into a little bit of chaos, right? Or a lot of chaos, depending, right? And then eventually a new status quo starts to manifest itself. So I started to have to learn myself how to step out of that role. And I think the family adjusted to that over time, right? Because I just wasn't going to take on that role. But, you know, that was also work, right? Because sometimes it's so subtle. Sometimes mm-hmm. you don't even realize you're doing it, right? I'm like, oh, you know, and even in my life, I would love to say I figured it all out. But, you know, even in life today, I'm like, oh, I'm falling into that role right here. I don't need to be here. I don't need to do that. I have to remind myself that's not my job.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's their stuff, their feelings. They can deal with it. You know,
yeah.
But it's hard.
Yeah. It's very easy to slip into.
I mean, that's how we, you know, I think when I look at it, you know, in our early attachments, right, we learned how to survive that way. That's the way I had to survive in my family and with everything that was going on in our family at the time. That's how I learned to survive. So it's very deep rooted in your psyche, right? These attachments are, you know, yeah, they're just deep rooted in there. And so for anybody who's going through this, right, it would be nice to be able to go, oh, I realize it now, I won't do it. But your brain isn't that cooperative. And your brain puts you back into these roles. And you're like, all of a sudden, you're like, wait a minute, I got to remind myself again. What am I doing here? This is crazy.
Yeah. And then for me, it was, you know, 2 years ago, it was realizing just how much of my healing had been from like the neck up and in my head.
Yeah.
Realizing how much the body really does keep the score.
Yeah. Isn't that a wonderful experience? I mean, it's
yeah,
great
because so you feel,
but it's like, oh, crap. Yeah. Yeah. You understand everything on this intellectual level. And then you understand like, oh, crap. This is playing out in my body and my nervous system. And that often drives our behavior. And then we have to do that somatic work. And it's like, here we are again. Right. But it's another layer of the onion. But I would say like each time I think it gets easier to do. I don't think it's as hard to do, if that makes sense. It doesn't necessarily, at least for me, some of the beginning realizations really rock your world and kind of really like you go through a lot of emotionality. I think it's, at least this is my experience, as you've done this work, it's gotten a little bit easier to do the work, if you relate to that.
I mean, I think sometimes the realization of still how much work there was to be done with everything that I was keeping in my body. Because kind of like the repercussions of that really caused me to slide back. Like, it was just like a perfect storm of just having, you know, abandonment trauma that I thought I had worked through. And it was just like, I just got sucked down a hole that, I mean, it was so incredibly painful. And it all happens the way that it's supposed to happen. But yeah, it was kind of brutal.
But I, you know, because I totally relate to what you're saying, because I've had that experience too. But there was a part of me that, I guess there was a part of me that knew, like, you had to do the work. I don't know if it's, it still sucked. I don't want to say it's
there still, is the part that's observing and kind of an awareness of what's going on. And there was a part that always held on to a hope. There's that part that has been through things and has seen the other side. So yeah, it was such a surreal experience to feel so insane yet so sane at the same time.
I totally get that. I totally relate to that.
It's such a bizarre, it's such a surreal experience. So yeah, I get that deeply. So when did you become a therapist?
I graduated with my master's in therapy in around 2003.
Okay.
I think I became licensed around 2005. I don't know the exact date, but it's in that area. It's in that time zone. And it was really a second career for me. I worked in the film industry for a while. I was a camera assistant. I wasn't a very good camera assistant when I look back, but I worked in the film industry for a while, and I actually was working on a set and I tripped over some four-aught cable, like cable for the running lights, and broke my leg, and I couldn't work, and I was on disability. And I'm not one to like totally sit around, and I'd always been interested in this. Like, I think when you do this work or you have this trauma or you're always kind of interested in it, right? Because you're trying to figure out your shit. And then, so there was this psychology class at Cal State Long Beach, and it was going to start. So I just went over and I met with the dean of the school and talked to him for like 2 hours about this. And I couldn't work anyway. And it was like a 6 weeks class, and I had 6 weeks of disability. And so he said, look, you know what, if you want to take it, it starts this weekend. Why don't you take it? And so I jumped into it. He was a great guy. His name was Vince. And I started doing it, and I kind of fell in love with it, and I really interested. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to take another class. And then there was like a 2-year transition of like going back and forth. And I said, well, I really want to do the schooling. So I started doing the schooling. And as I started doing schooling, you know, I started missing jobs in the film industry. And as you meet Phil, you know, they don't call you back the next time. So it's like got less and less. And then I remember there's a big job I got asked to do, and I turned it down. And I knew that was like, in that moment, I knew that
it's kind of the nail in the coffin.
Yeah. I knew at that moment. And I mean, it was a hard thing to do because I spent a lot of time in this, and I love film. I have a passion for film. And I think that's also a reason why I do a podcast. It's almost like a creative endeavor, right? I love documentary films too. So doing a podcast is kind of like doing documentaries and stuff. So, but I kind of knew like that was it. That was it. I had made up my mind and then went full into it, and I've loved it. It was a really good decision. And I love doing the work that I'm doing now. I love helping people. I love working with people. I love seeing people thrive and get better, right? What else is there to do, right? I mean, so I feel very, very lucky that I get to do this and work with this in this field.
I'm curious what it's been like for you to observe, and wherever you kind of want to take this, but as far as just like with the internet, just how you've seen things progress, transform from the perspective of process addictions, from the perspective of technology, of access to porn, just like what has it just been like to sort of just witness things evolve over time?
Yeah, that's a really, really great question. I think, you know, I've because of my early experiences in recovery and doing that kind of recovery work, it's always been a part of me, right? I mean, that was a profound experience to go into a rehab and do deep work at 17 years old. mean, it's just a profound experience. It shaped me. You know, when you do that recovery work, it makes you look inward. It makes you, you know, it makes you do that work. So it's always been a part of it. And I was always interested in it. And especially because of my own, you know, I like to call it my own addicted mind, right? My own brain that has this propensity for addiction. And so, you know, I think that's always been a part of it for me. Doing this work, I always had an interest in that. And then watching, you know, when I started, when I was getting my hours to get licensed as a therapist, I worked in a treatment program, and it was for, at the time, I don't know if it's still, if they still do this, it was called Prop 36. It was in California, and it was like addiction treatment in lieu of jail time, right? So I'd work with people who were struggling with addiction. They were nonviolent offenders, and they were trying to get better and work with that. And as I worked deeply with these clients, some of the stuff that came up were these process addictions. And that was like, you know, it's like, hey, I have this problem with these drugs, but, you know, I haven't told anybody this, but I got this other problem that I feel is like really bugging me. And I feel like sex is out of control for me. Right. And so that's where I started to look at that as I did this training and started to work on that. And that's where I started to get training for that piece and digging into that. And that's how I became a certified sex addiction therapist. I did their training, and they were just, that was back in the day when they were just starting this program out, and sex addiction was still really looked as at as, I don't want to say taboo, but it was not really, no one wanted to talk about it, right? No one wanted to talk about compulsive sexuality or out of control sexual behavior. Like, we just don't talk about that. We'll talk about all the other addictive stuff, but we won't talk about that. But once that door started to open, people started to come and get support for it, right? And say, well, yeah, I got this problem too. And they felt safe enough to start to get help. Now, with that, as I've seen the progress, you're talking about the internet coming in here. When I started, most of the clients that would reach out to me would be, you know, in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, right? And you could kind of say it was classic sex addiction, right? They were maybe struggling with compulsive hooking up with prostitutes or massage parlors. They were stuck in this, and you know, they were either destroying their marriage, right? Their marriage is now blown up because of this, or they get arrested in a sting because of this and everything. But most of these people were dealing with this, and they were coming in, like I said, in their maybe their 40s, 50s, and 60s. But in the last while, in the last 10, almost 15 years now, I'm getting younger people coming in. I'm getting 22-year-olds reaching out to me and going, I got this problem. Like, porn has taken over my life. Like, it's, I'm engulfed in it and I can't stop. But these are like, you know, I call them kids now. They're like 22. They're not kids. They're adults, but they're coming in, these young, and it's very different from when I was working with these older individuals. It was a whole different piece because these kids, call them kids, they're not really kids, they're adults. But these younger adults that were coming in, they had exposure to pornography, high intensity, high speed internet porn when, you know, when they're 10, 11, 12 years old. And it was a whole different thing. And so when they're coming in at 21, 22, 23, this has become like so ingrained in their life. They can't break free and they can't have a functional relationship
or never had one, or they can't,
it's almost like their arousal template is completely reset to this high-speed internet porn, and the isolation and the depression and the anxiety that come with that, it's heartbreaking for these younger adults. And so that's a whole new population. And it's a little bit of a different kind of work because in some ways, these older people coming in, there was a lot of shame around it. And so just about the behavior itself. And so you're working through a lot of that. With these younger individuals, there wasn't the same kind of moral conflict with the sexuality piece. In a way there was, but it's not the same. It's different. You know, they've been engrossed in this pornography for so long that it's just, it is what it is, right? It's like everybody's looking at this. So there's that. And then also seeing a big uptick of women coming in for more compulsive porn use as well. And at the beginning when I did this work, that was very, very rare for a woman to reach out to us. But now we're seeing that as well. And so, you know, I think the internet has a big piece to that. And I'll add one more I Please. Think is kind of interesting, is the older people who didn't grow up with internet pornography in their life actually have an easier time stopping than these young people who are exposed to internet pornography from a very young age. It seems to even be a harder thing to stop and gain control of and figure out what is healthy sexuality for me. What does it look like? You know, they don't even have an idea of what that is.
Well, how much of it is, are you saying, is more difficult to recover from, like actually abstain from the behavior versus also then figure out all the identity piece? Well, I would assume like part of it is like the development of the brain, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like they're getting access and exposure to this at an age when the brain is still developing. And then I would also think when, you know, what you just said is, I don't remember exactly how you worded it, but, you know, like figuring out a sexual healthy identity and what it is that I want. I mean, it was never given the chance to develop in a healthy way, correct?
Yeah, exactly. So I think we're just starting to have to figure that out. In some ways, we don't even know what we got to do with this, right? Because it's really this first generation now that has been exposed to this kind of pornography. We've never had that in the history of humanity, right? Mm-hmm. This high-speed, constant internet porn that has filled with novelty, right? Because you can endlessly scroll and get endless new stimulation. And we know the brain is wired for sexual novelty. So this is a new thing that we haven't seen. So how is that going to impact everybody's brain? Now, some people, I think it'll probably play out very similar to addiction in general. Some people will go, nah, I'm done. I'm, you know, not good for me. And they move on. And then there are other people who will, you know, their brain is just going to be wired for that piece, either through their own biology, through trauma, through whatever. They're going to have a more difficult time struggling with it.
Yeah. So I've been talking about my phone addiction for several years now. As somebody, you know, I've been sober now from drugs and alcohol for 17 years. And as somebody who was, I was not functional, you know, I was a total shit show. To have this other addiction that is much more quote unquote functional, I mean, it's just been so easy for me to really dismiss it in general, to dismiss the impact of it, to dismiss the severity of it. And for me, it's mostly showed up in games. Like I was a Candy Crush addict for a very long time. I then switched to a different game. So now it's going to be 2 weeks on Thursday that I haven't played any game on my phone. And this is probably the longest, Wayne, I've gone in like 8 years. Yeah. And, you know, maybe three years ago, I was diagnosed with ADHD, but I don't think I have ADHD. I think it's the changes that my phone has done to my brain, like for real. Because I never had these issues before. I mean, I was a CPA. I never had these issues in studying. Like all of these symptoms that I now develop that are like ADHD symptoms, these are also all of the symptoms of what happens to your brain from long-term phone use.
I've had the same experience. I've had the exact same experience. So I think, you know, like putting this together, like these games and these phones, they have been able to test this on millions and millions and millions and millions of people and millions of hours of data. And so they know exactly how to move your brain in that direction. Now, also combine that with pornography, right? The same thing, right? I mean, I can totally relate to the phone, and that's a struggle Yeah, I still have today. I'm like, I don't, why, what, why am I picking up my phone? Why am I? But it's wired for that. I mean, I think eventually, you know, I've been talking, you know, we're talking about some of these younger kids. Some of these younger kids, you know, that are 14 and 15 are like talking about this stuff is bad. I want to get rid of it, right? I don't want this in my life. They're realizing they're being manipulated by these phones. And so that's kind of hopeful for me that that's going to take place. And maybe we'll find some way to get these phones out, that they're just not good for us. Just like, you know, we learn now that like smoking is not good for you. Alcohol is not good for you. There's a whole movement. Just alcohol is just unhealthy. It's like, it's just bad, right? You don't do that to your body. It's just not good, right? So hopefully we'll do that with phones too.
I don't know. That'd be nice, but I don't know.
They don't want us to do that. Right? These companies don't want us to do that. All right. I'm an optimist. What can I say?
Yeah. You know, you hear so much of, and it's interesting because it was like when I'm like looking, you know, really wanting to find either a doctor or a psychologist that really focuses on phone addiction. And it's so interesting just how much of the conversation is so full, like solely focused on kids. And it's like, it's got to be just as big of a problem as it is for adults. How many people have been diagnosed with ADHD because of the damage that technology has done to their brain? So I'm curious with this, like, is this coming into the conversation as far as like when you're looking at porn addiction, like what sort of, how is that coming into the discussion as far as like treatment is concerned when we're really looking at the damage that has been caused? And I just feel like we're almost dealing with something that is this technology element to me just seems like we're bringing in another element that really has to be tackled and addressed. And like, you know, you know, 12 steps worked with like for getting me sober, but I'm just wondering like what sort of research or discussion is there.
I think they're definitely, you know, we're definitely looking at all of that, because I think people do realize that the phone has this addictive potential. Oh, the way the phone works now as it is. What's interesting is you're talking about that. You know, a lot of clients that come in and they're really struggling with porn, they actually get rid of their phones.
Interesting.
You know, they actually move to a dumb phone. Or they have their phone really locked down, mm-hmm. right? And these are people like, I want to make a better life for myself. And so they realize that, you know, the thing with pornography, it's available right at your fingertips. That's also another thing we didn't have, right? This is new mm-hmm. with technology. You had to go somewhere. There's a hurdle for access. You know, these apps make any of those hurdles. They want to erase all those hurdles, right? So that it's so fast and easy for you to get it. And you don't have time. Your brain doesn't have time to put the brakes on it, mm-hmm. right? And say, wait a minute. That's not a good idea, mm-hmm. right? They want to move from that impulse to action, and they want to make that super fast. This is my belief, right?
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So that, you know, you make the purchase. Or you click the button, right? And then they want to keep that engagement with you, right? And so, yeah, I have a lot of clients that they just get off. They just get a really simple phone. And I know there's a whole movement out there of people looking for dumb phones, right? Functional dumb phones. I've definitely looked at that for myself because, you know, the phone, it's like, it's in your pocket. And then all of a sudden you're like,
it's in my hand. News
or checking email. I'm like, I don't need to check email. I didn't get an email like 5 minutes ago. Why am I checking it again? I'm not going to get like an email. It's like, but that's a dopamine hit, right? It's a dopamine
100%.
Hit. 100%. I am totally checking this email for no other reason that maybe I'll get an email that maybe I need to respond to. I don't even know. Right. And it's like, and you don't even realize you're doing it. It's crazy.
I'm curious when you made the comment about sort of like the moral dilemma, heaviness of it not being as present for, you know, younger adults that are coming in related to the porn addiction as they would with more of like the sexual compulsions that you were mostly working with earlier in your career. What is it typically that is drawing these younger folks in to seek treatment? Is there any sort of themes or patterns there as far as what is getting people in the door? Is it mostly like deep, deep, deep isolation?
I think for a lot of them coming in, there's a deep realization that their life is, in a way, passing them by, right? So there's a combination of things. There's like, this feels out of control to me. It is taking up so much of my time, right? So I'm spending 2 or 3 hours looking at porn every day, right? I don't have that isolation too. Maybe I don't have a relationship, or they're in a relationship and they can't function in the relationship. Like, they lose sexual function. They, you know, for men, they can't get an erection, right? Unless porn is present, right? So they're with their partner and they can't have sex, you know, unless porn is part of it. Maybe their partner doesn't want that, right? So there's a multitude of things that are going on. But I think the number one thing I see is just this is consuming my life. It's consuming my time. It's consuming everything about them. Now, I was talking about that shame piece, right? I think for the younger generation, you know, they've grown up with porn everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. And everybody talks about porn and everybody. So there's not this shame around like the porn, the sexuality itself per se. There might be a lot of shame about the amount.
Yeah, the loss of time. Yeah,
the loss of time and that they're, and it's compulsive. But the material itself doesn't have that. Well, what I found in older generations, there was this shame around the sexuality itself as well, mixed into that. So I think that might be a little bit of a difference. That's just from anecdotal experience.
Are you seeing less people seeking treatment for kind of more of the sexual compulsion where it's not porn related? Like, are you seeing less of that now?
No, I wouldn't say that I'm seeing less of that, but it's definitely the internet and internet pornography now play into it a lot more. Okay. Right. So they're kind of fused together. So they all kind of start to mix together.
And then, so you have this, what you said, it's called resilience.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Related to this kind of betrayal, relationship betrayal, specifically with men. I'm curious, are you seeing a difference in impact when the betrayal is coming more from an internet and porn place than it would be from like classic infidelity?
Yes and no. That's a complicated answer here. Let's first just go into what betrayal is, because I think that's kind of key to understand that, especially intimate betrayal. So when someone is in a relationship and they have an idea of what the relationship is, this is what, you know, this is our agreement, right? Where maybe it's, we agree that we're monogamous and that this is what's going on. When someone does something that betrays that, like, or does the partner who's been betrayed, they're going along thinking the relationship is like this, right? This is what I think the relationship is. And then all of a sudden they get this new piece of information, meaning you've been acting out with other people or prostitutes or massage parlors, or you've been looking at porn and you said you weren't looking at porn. This new piece of information changes the whole dynamic of what they thought the relationship was. And this often puts the betrayed partner into a deep crisis, right? Because for a lot of these people, they're going along, maybe they've been married for 30 years thinking this is their relationship. And all of a sudden they find out their partner has been having sex with prostitutes or acting out in massage parlors or going online and chatting with others. And so their world is literally rocked by that. And for the person who is doing the betrayal, right, and has this deceptive sexuality, right, when they're deceiving a partner, they have to gaslight their partner. They have to lie to their partner. They're not honest, right? So not only is it like the behavior that comes along and goes, what, I thought our marriage was this, or I thought our relationship was this, and now I'm realizing you've been lying to me this whole time. And for the betrayed person, that often causes post-traumatic stress. I mean, that sounds like a lot, but it causes post-traumatic stress And so they then have this huge crisis on their hands, right? And the person who's done the betrayal, oftentimes they're doing this and then they get caught, mm-hmm. right? And everything falls apart. And they want to save this relationship. They want to work on this relationship. They want to heal the relationship. Well, if they're going to do that, they have to really be able to be present for their partner to be able to do that, right? But if they have their own shame, they end up not being able to be present. And so they can't heal the relationship. So the person who's done the betrayal has to hold two roles here. They have to be able to be present and hear the pain that they've caused their partner from this betrayal. And they're also the one that has done all the harm. So they got to sit with both of those pieces in themselves if they want to be able to heal this relationship. And that's where a lot of people end up, a lot of relationships get stuck because they can't move through that piece.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it's like, I wonder, like, how does one hold space for both? And then on top of it, I mean, I'm sure when one's confronting their own shame, I mean, that's so layered. It's not like,
so
that's not just dealing with Mm-mm. what this present circumstance nope. that we have at hand. This is, you know, this is a lifetime of shame that's probably never been dealt
that's
with.
Totally
and so
true.
A large part of me feels like that a lot of attention probably has to go there in order for them to be able to hold the space and respect that the other person's betrayal deserves. But I would kind of, it's kind of an inside job, right? Well,
it is, but this is the hard part. I think for the person who's done the betrayal, right? They don't have that betrayal trauma. And so they have to really be willing to understand the depth and pain that comes with this kind of betrayal for their partner. They have to really understand the impact that all of their deceptive sexuality had on their partner. So not just the betrayal, like, oh my gosh, I found out this information, but oh my gosh, but you lied to me. You gaslit me. You put me at risk at times. You took away my consent for the relationship. I wouldn't have consented to this relationship. But because you lied to me, how am I supposed to have consent? So the person who's done the betrayal has to understand that piece, right? And that means they have to look back on themselves and they have to take accountability for that harm caused. And then what does that do? That creates a lot of internal shame. And like you were saying, that deep history of shame is probably there. That's probably one of the reasons they are engaging in compulsive sexuality in the first place, mm-hmm. right? So there's this whole thing that they have to do. Now, this is what in my experience of like sitting with couples and working with couples and working through this piece, if the partner's done the betrayal, can really dig in and work on this shame piece, they can get the emotional regulation part to be able to show up in a way for their partner to help their partner heal their nervous system over time. But it takes a lot of time, right? And yeah, we're not talking you're going to do this in a month. This is a 3 to 5 year process. But, you know, for people who are struggling through this, right? Many people, they have a lot of time and they have kids in their relationship. There's a lot of reasons to stay in this relationship that are valid to stay there, right? And work on this. And often the person who's in the addiction, it's hard, you know, how do you betray somebody and still love them at the same time? There's that understanding to be able to work through. But there are a lot of reasons, a lot of good reasons to work on a relationship. And actually, most relationships do stay together, right? I think it's like 60 to 70% really? In the research of relationships stay together after infidelity and betrayal. It's a very high number.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that's because they've done the work and they've worked through,
that's
right?
True,
that's just a number
right?
that they stay together, right?
They stay together. But if you really want to dig in and do the work, you've got to do that shame piece. And now this is the other hard part, right? Is the person who's done the betrayal has done this awful thing, right? They've hurt the very person they most likely care about, right? The most. They've hurt their family. They've hurt their relationship. And so the problem is, it's like, well, if you go and you approach that, the betrayer, with like, look how awful you are, right? That's going to beget more shame. That's going to beget more, they're going to be more shut down. So they have to be able to have what I call compassionate accountability, mm-hmm. right? They have to be accountable and own the impact of what they've done, but it has to be done through the lens of compassion and kindness. If you try and heal that through the lens of shame, nothing works. It will not work. But with that, so the person who's done the betrayal, if they do that deep shame work, right, they can actually start to have compassion for themselves. They can take ownership, right? And they can also learn to forgive themselves and to work on understanding why and the reasons and all of that. Mm-hmm. And then they can show up for their partner in that deeper way, right? With that deep accountability, that deep remorse, which the partner needs to be able to see in order to heal. And that takes time, but they really have to be willing to dig into the work. And when I particularly work with men, when I see men who do that deep work, the transformation is amazing for them, but also amazing for their partner. And then you see a new relationship come out of this that is deeper, more meaningful. I mean, you know that when you do this recovery work, you can't help but have mm-hmm. deeper relationships with people when you do this deep work. It just happens, right? And so that's pretty amazing to see, but it's hard work. It's hard work.
I would be curious if the couples where you are seeing that success, or the men who are able to get to this place of this compassionate accountability that you say, how many of those men are people that have dealt with other, like, that are people that maybe struggled with alcoholism or addiction, or people that kind of have a past experience of working through things? I would think that maybe that would be more likely for them.
You would be surprised at how many people come to see me who have maybe 10 years of sobriety,
yeah, exactly,
from a substance, mm-hmm. right? And this is the one thing that they kept hidden because of the shame around it. Once again, we don't talk about it. No one knows how to talk about it. So they'll have substance recovery, right? With that said, oftentimes this leads them to do that deeper work. You know, that really like digging in. And oftentimes this is where they'll dig into that. You know, you're talking head up and right? They'll start to do that body, that somatic work, that deeper trauma work that they maybe, for whatever reason,
dismissed or discounted.
Discounted, dismissed, couldn't do, right? Now they're kind of forced to have to do it. If they want to keep their relationship together, right? They're going to have to do this work. And there's just no way around it. You can't have that deep relationship without doing that deep work. In my opinion, you just can't do it. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, I would imagine that this is just the way a lot of people's unresolved trauma is like coming to the surface. I mean, for mm-hmm. me, it was like in these, you know, horrible relationships just with, you know, active alcoholics or emotionally unavailable men. And I'm just curious on the male perspective, like how often it would then be manifesting through, you know, like a porn addiction or sexual compulsion.
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. A lot of the men who struggle with compulsive sexuality fall on that dismissive attachment. Mm-hmm. Not all of them, but a lot. There's a higher priority of that, meaning they've learned to self-soothe and self-isolate, mm-hmm. right? So they aren't emotionally available, right? And also, the other part is just male socialization and the man mm-hmm. box, right? Mm-hmm. Being told, if you express emotionality, right, some kind of emotion besides maybe anger, right? Anger and rage. But if you express anything else, you're weak, right? You got to stay in the man box. So men and boys learn very early on to shrink their emotional life, And that's why I think also part of this, so they can't have deep relationships with anybody, right? And, you know, sexual arousal becomes the closest thing they can do to escape that loneliness, right? To escape that those deeper painful feelings, they can become sexually aroused, and then they don't have to experience that. They don't experience that deep loneliness, right? And so they're also, you know, men doing this work, they have to undo that, right? They have to learn to sit with that and step out of that man box to be able to share how they feel, right? To form meaningful relationships with other men, right? What's really amazing in some of my groups that I lead, and this is, it almost in a way breaks my heart, right? Because it's like, I have these men and maybe some of them are in their 60s, almost even 70s. And this is the first time they've had deep relationships with other men in their life. And it's just like, that's tragic to me, right? I mean, this is the first time in a recovery group in this way, doing this deep work, this is the first time they feel like they're having meaningful relationships with other men, which is just, that blows me away, right? It's so sad, but they need to do that to be also to heal. And so, and heal their relationship, right? They can start there and they can learn to be more vulnerable with themselves.
Is there any sort of do you see any sort of a difference there as far as like I mean, the brains are getting impacted at such a younger level, but I'm curious, do you see any difference there in a young adult who, you know, is struggling more with like porn addiction as compared to like, you know, a more middle-aged man, like struggling with more sexual compulsivity? Are the younger adults more willing and open to go to a place of vulnerability faster?
It's a good question. I think so. I think there is a difference because there's a lot of these younger individuals that are more open to that a little bit, right? It's a little bit different, has a different feeling to it. So a lot of the times the people that I'm working with, they're in their 40s, 50s, and 60s when I work, especially the Shame to Resilience, you know, workshop that we do. That's usually older people that have had, you know, they have an established relationship that they want to work on their shame so they can work to repair the relationship and in a way make amends for the harm caused. We also, some of my colleagues here at our agency work with groups of just younger men, right? So in their 20s to 35, right? And just because it's a different
ball game.
It's a different ball game. I guess that's the best way to put it. So those men feel better in that age group. And, you know, I guess also where you are in your life too plays into that. But oftentimes these younger men are dealing primarily with the compulsive porn use, right? Sometimes it's acting out behaviors, but it's more like the porn.
Well, it's interesting because a couple weeks ago, I was really trying to look at the difference between like, I mean, a betrayal bond is a form of a trauma bond, but like really in trying to differentiate between the two. And so I'm wondering, how are you seeing that kind of come into play? I mean, I guess that's more so like from the perspective of women maybe sticking around when things aren't changing, but are you seeing that come into play or not as much because I guess maybe the men that would be in those situations would be less likely to. What about, I mean, are you having a lot of men coming in that are like they're talking the talk, but they're not really trying to walk the walk as far in trying to save the relationship, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, I do see that. Right. And you know, what I would say, well, a couple things there, right. So for a betrayed partner, I mean, we all bring our history to a relationship. Like we can't help it, right? We bring our attachment styles. We bring our stuff to a relationship and we are wired for attachment. So relationships, once they're together, they're very, very sticky, right? We don't leave relationships actually that easily, right? It takes a lot for us to actually leave a relationship. So there's that pulling them back together. And then everybody brings in their stuff, right, to the relationship. But I think what's really, really an important piece here, and this gets overlooked, is that often the person who's been betrayed can get blamed for the betrayal, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you should have seen it. You should have known. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that, you know, there was deception. There was gaslighting. It was hidden. It was, you know, the person chose to give somebody the benefit of the doubt, right? Which you would do in a relationship when you trust them. You give people the benefit of the doubt. And if someone's lying to you and manipulating you, right, that is not your fault. You cannot see that, right? And so it's I think we have to be really, really careful that partners oftentimes who have been betrayed get blamed for not seeing it or not knowing it or not being aware of it. The reality is it was deceptive, right? And that's the nature of deception. You can't see it, right? So there's that piece. I think that has to be, you know, that's really important to be able to say. And then the next thing is adding to that is that, you know, in relationships, we want to stay in relationships. We want to work it out. And oftentimes people in these relationships for the betrayed partner, and this gets really hard, is that they see the betrayal and, you know, all that piece. And then they also know this person on this other side of this person, right? Some of the good things about them. You know, sometimes some of these men are incredible fathers in a way, incredible supporters of the family. And sometimes that is so traumatic because how do I wrap those two mm-hmm. pieces together, right? Here's this side of you that I saw that was really wonderful. And I thought that that's what it was. And then here I'm finding out all this information that you've been having affairs or acting out with sex workers and putting me at risk. I don't know how to put those together, right? And so that's also part of the trauma and all the pieces there. So, you know, it gets complicated pretty fast.
How are children coming in to play with this? And like, how are you navigating how to discuss this with their kids? And is there any a point where you would bring the children into the therapy process?
Yeah, that's oh my gosh, that's a good question too. So most of the time, you know, there's like, I kind of say there's like four phases mm-hmm. when you go through this, right? There's what I call the first phase is the crisis phase, right? That's discovery. That's where everything is like, oh my gosh, what do we do? Right? We don't even know what to do. And that's like, you know, okay, now maybe we got to go find help. We got to go find a support group. We got to go do this. You know, if there's legal issues, we got to figure out all that. So there's this crisis phase, right? And that's usually, sometimes that can last for 6 months to a year, trying to figure out that. Then the next phase of this is what I call the scaffolding phase. And this is where you start to build the structure for the relationship. So the person who's done the betrayal has to show up in a way that can tell the partner, okay, I'm changing and I'm safe, right? So scaffolding is, because there's so much intensity with the trauma, you know, it's like, I'm going to check in with you every week to show you the work that I'm doing, right? I'm going to be transparent. You have access to all my devices, right? You can track my location if you need to, right? So you create this scaffolding, the structure, right? That allows you to get to the next phase, which I call is like safety building, cultivating safety. And this is where the person who's done the betrayal is learning to show up for their partner, not move to that dismissive attachment if that's their issue, or withdrawal or avoid, or, you know, attack self or attack other, all the things that fall on the shame compass. So they're learning to be present, and that starts to build safety. Okay, I can see that you're committed to this process. The partner can then risk a little bit of trust, right, with them after they got that scaffolding and then that safety keeping. And I'm going to get back to your question in a second and then after that, right, after there's a certain level of safety, that's where the repair starts to happen. The post-traumatic stress, you know, the post-traumatic growth from the post-traumatic stress starts to come, right? They start to actually really get to a deep level and build that deep level of intimacy that they never had. But that's a lot of work, but it's pretty predictable in the phases. What I'd say when it comes back to family and kids, we've got to get that scaffolding in place, right? We've got to get that there's some level of safety here that we can bring that in to, you know, the family dynamics. What I often see is that's where, you know, kids know what's going on, but maybe at this time they can get a better explanation of what's happening at age appropriate levels, right?
Yeah.
And often the person, if they're really doing this work, maybe they'll write an amends letter or they'll talk to the kids. I want to tell you what was going on. And this is the work that I've been doing to make amends for the harm I've caused, right? And they take ownership of it and they invite the other family members to be a part of that if they want to, right? And so it's almost that amends process. But, you know, and every, you know, every family is a little bit different. So you have to really, you know, you want to bring in a therapist that has some experience in this so they can help guide you in that process. But that's usually where the family comes in, or relatives too, right? Because oftentimes when there's this big betrayal, you know, other family members know, right? And they don't know how do I talk to your husband now that I know all this information, right? That he was doing all these things, because it, you know, comes out, you know, somehow in the crisis. And so they have to like learn to navigate that. But, you know, that once again, as people do this deeper work, other people see the change, right? What I see over and over again is when the betrayer digs into this work, the betrayed is looking to see how they're going to show up, right? And should look at that. Like, I gotta see noticeable trustworthy behaviors from you to see if I'm going to take this risk with you, right? And they start to see the person change because they start to see them working to show up. Not perfection, right? But they see them making the efforts to be transparent, the efforts to be understanding, the efforts to listen and reflect back, the efforts to take accountability, right? It doesn't have to be perfect, right? It really doesn't. But the partner can go, okay, I can see that this person is trying to change. Now I'm going to hang out a little bit longer and see if that change is enough, right? And they get there. Right?
That brings up something interesting. And I echo and agree with what you said about that, you know, like the betrayed not being blamed. However, I do think that, like, you know, if we are bringing like years of dynamics with each other and it's like, you know, we're drawn to each other for a reason. Mm-hmm. And so I would imagine too, though, I mean, you might have, you know, decades or years of our own unresolved shit that is coming into a play, and that like has, well, I'm not saying they caused them to do that. It's playing a role in the dynamic. It's still a part of the story. And so I'm wondering from that perspective, I'm also wondering too, like, when are you having the betrayed who is so focused on what has been done to them and not really stepping up to the plate to really look at their own shit too. And that's not from the perspective of like what was done to them, but you know, they got their, own history of stuff that has not been looked at or resolved either.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's going to play out. Mm-hmm. What I would say is that somebody has to go first when we're healing a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And in a betrayed situation, it is the responsibility of the betrayer to go first and build safety. What I see naturally happen as they do this work and they move through those four phases, right? And they start getting to that fourth phase, maybe even a little bit in the third phase where they've got some safety building, it starts to become mutual. And the betrayed person, they feel safe enough to do their work. To do your work on a relationship, you have to be vulnerable, right? To do that deep work, to own your stuff in a relationship with somebody else, you have to have vulnerability. But the person who's done the betrayal has to prove that they're safe first. Then you get to that work. So in some ways, when you start this work, it is not an equal playing field at all, right? It is the person who's done the betrayal's responsibility to bring safety back to the relationship And then at some point, yeah, you got to have a mutual relationship. No one wants to be in a relationship where one person's up and one person's down. That's not going to work. Right?
I mean, are you seeing, I'm sure you're seeing where the betrayed continues to hold this over the other person in spite of them doing the other work and also not willing to do their part. I'm sure you're seeing that play out.
That does happen. Mm-hmm. That does happen. Like they get into that trauma piece and mm-hmm. for them, it becomes really hard for them to step out.
Yep.
But I want to put a caveat in here because I mm-hmm. see this all the time. Often the betrayer is jumping the gun here mm-hmm. and they haven't really earned that piece yet. Mm-hmm. Right. They really haven't done the work to show up and to show that they're a safe person. Mm-hmm. Right. At this point. So there is that. But there is a point where some relationships that I do see, for whatever reason, the person who's been betrayed can't move through the trauma. They're having a really, really difficult time.
Yeah, they kind of
get stuck there. And there is a point where the person who's done the betrayal may have to make a choice if mm-hmm. they want to be in the relationship or not. Mm-hmm. But what I would say, oftentimes that gets brought up earlier than it should, mm-hmm. right? That the person who's done the betrayal doesn't understand the deep level of trauma that comes with you know, deceptive sexuality. They don't understand that. They're not doing their own shame work. So they're not showing up with empathetic presence, right? Being able to really sit with their partner's pain and sit there with it. So they aren't bringing those to the table. And so they kind of throw it back to the person who's been betrayed and like, you're not doing your work, right? Mm-hmm, when they really have to dig in and do this deep work. Mm-hmm. And so we have to really be aware of that piece. But, you know, like you said, there does come a time where, you know, and I've seen that happen, right? I would like to say every relationship can heal from this. Not every relationship does.
Yeah, of course not. Just,
that's the reality, right? But, you know, relationships can and do. I mean, I've been doing this work long enough to see the whole process and move people all the way through to the other side, right? Which is a 3 to 5 year process, right? Mm-hmm. So I've been able to sit with couples and work through them and do this work. And the one thing I can see over and over again is the relationships that do heal, the person who's done the betrayal jumps headfirst into their work and just surrenders to that process and says, this is what I got to do to heal. Mm-hmm. This is what I got to do to heal myself and heal my partner. And they make the transition where they're like, I'm doing this work regardless as if mm-hmm. my partner stays with mm-hmm. me or not. I'm going to do the work no matter what. And when a person transitions to that, right, it doesn't usually start out that way, right? I got to save my relationship. Oh my God, everything's falling apart, right? Hair's on fire. That's how we all start, right? And then, but then there's this transition where they're like, I'm doing this work no matter what. So, you know, hopefully my partner will stay with me.
So who is like the target audience for your From Shame to Resilience program?
For the Shame to Resilience, it's for men who have betrayed their relationship through deceptive sexuality. And maybe they've tried a lot of things. Maybe they've tried individual therapy. Maybe they've tried couples therapy. Maybe they've been part of a community of some sort and they're still feeling like their relationship is stuck. They're still feeling like we're stuck here. We can't move past this piece. We're not making that connection. Most likely there's that shame component in it for the person who's done the betrayal. So the Shame to Resilience is about that piece, specifically for men too, because, and I know that men are betrayed as well. I don't want to, I know that's a reality as well. And I know sometimes they don't get as much support as they need. Mm-hmm. And I hear that. And maybe we'll work on that too. But working on, you know, men who also have to understand how masculinity and male socialization has played a role in all of this. You know, they have to understand empathy and how to show up, and they have to learn how to regulate their shame to do all of those things. So it's about that component. And they work together, right? We also do this in groups, right? So you don't heal shame
alone.
Alone. You can't. It's a social emotion. Mm-hmm. You need other people. I've never been able to heal any of my shame sitting by myself. I've mm-hmm. healed my shame when I've been able to express it to other people who can compassionately understand and mirror back to me compassion and help me walk through it. And that's what we do. Yeah, to be witnessed, right? We got to be witnessed in it. I mean, mm-hmm. that's just the reality of it. So we do it that way and we walk through it. And oftentimes, you know, it's awesome to see, because I also talk to the partners, and because I ask partners, like, are you seeing change in your partner? Right. Yeah. I mean, and that gets exciting, because then I know, like, okay, this is working, because you know, their partners are happy that they're doing this. Right. Because the partner can get what they need. Right. Which is that empathy, that understanding, that presence, that deep remorse for the pain caused. Right. And they can sit with that because they're not mired in their shame response. Because if they're mired in their shame response, they're just going to be defensive. Mm-hmm. They're going to or withdraw or shut down. Right. And then the person who has been harmed can't get that piece that they need to heal.
It's fascinating. So when do you have a new cohort starting soon, or?
Yeah, we have a new cohort coming up in 2 weeks.
Oh, awesome. Okay. Well,
so, I would just say go to workshop.shametoresilience.com, you know, and check it out. Right. And if it's a fit for you, jump in with us and do it. It's worth the work, right? It's like just so worth the work. Mm-hmm. Shame is sucky.
No kidding.
Shame is awful. Yeah. It's the worst feeling ever, you know, and that's the other, you know, shame, depression, anxiety all go together. So there's a lot of work when you're doing this work. I think especially in the addiction field, there's a big chunk of shame that has to be worked on. And the more we can talk about it, the better we feel.
Shine a light on that shame. Well, this has been great. I really appreciate you talking about these issues. And yeah, it's really great to dive into it. So definitely will have you back on to dive into it more. So
yeah, I appreciate it.
Yeah, this was great.